From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, she made heavy use of line item vetoes to carve nearly $1 billion from the new state budget.
The budgets that were sent to me were a mess in a number of regards, and that's why I took the actions that I did.
We'll talk with Governor Whitmer about what comes next. Plus, we talk about the investigation into President Trump's phone call to the president of Ukraine with Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Dingell.
My job is to protect the national security of this country and to protect the Constitution. I take an oath to do that.
And GOP Congressman Fred Upton.
I don't know that anyone is really silent. This is not an issue that you can go hide in the corner on.
And we learn about the Great Michigan Fire of 1871. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we'll hear from U.S. Representatives Fred Upton and Debbie Dingell, who've been spreading a message of restoring civility and bipartisanship in American politics and culture.
They have different life experiences, different perspectives, but they all love this country. They're all Americans. And we got to talk to each other. We got to hear each other. We've got to understand perspectives.
Before that, though, first, let's talk about this. Today, Governor Gretchen Whitmer announced she would submit a supplemental spending plan to the legislature. That means she's throwing her budget priorities back to Republican lawmakers after reworking and vetoing parts of the budget that they sent to her. Here is Republican Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky reacting to Whitmer's supplemental plan.
I'm afraid that the budget is done now. You know, and so I think we should go back to the table and start talking about what's next for Michigan and for the legislature's priorities and so forth and her priorities. But the budget is essentially done.
Well, here to talk more about her spending plan and this budget going forward is Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Governor, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia. Glad to be with you.
We just heard from Senator Shirky. Republican leaders say they're done negotiating. The budget process is over. What do you say to that?
Well, unfortunately, the truth of the matter is we still have a lot of work left to do. I think it's important that we put our differences aside and get serious about mending some of the glaring holes that are in the budget that impact public safety. We're talking about people's lives, and we're talking about hundreds of state employees who may not be able to continue doing the work that they're doing if the budget stands as it currently is. And so I think it's important for everyone that we get back to the table and negotiate. Supplementals are always in order and always a part of ongoing decision making. And so it is absolutely the right time and the right thing to get started.
But you say that and he said, we're done. And so what's the way forward through that impasse?
Well, we've got a lot of work yet to do. And while he said we're done with the budget, we're always going to continue to have ongoing conversations in the form of policy, in the form of supplementals. And so I don't think that changes anything. I've invited the legislative leaders over for a quadrant meeting tomorrow, and all four of them will be joining me, and we're going to talk about where we go from here. But as I said, we are all Michiganders. We need to be focused on public safety and health and welfare. And that's precisely what I am, what I took my oath of office to do and what I am focused on.
What would your supplemental budget look like? What isn't being funded right now that you want to see get attention and get money?
So, Cynthia, in order to cobble together the talking point road plan that they created, they stole $400 million from various parts of the budget. They pretended that there were fund balances to replace those dollars. They misused restricted funds and tried to lapse work projects. All of this sounds like, gobbledygook to your listeners, I'm sure. But it's a phony budget. And it's also that they could have a talking point about $400 million going into roads, which we know is only going to pave 39 miles of roads in a state that has 55,000 that need to be rebuilt. It only rebuilds 4 bridges in a state with over 1,000 bridges that needs to be rebuilt. And so it was not a real infrastructure plan, but it came at a great cost. Over $45 million to the Department of Corrections, which means we'd have to close a couple of prisons to absorb that. We'd have to stop monitoring sex offenders and drunk drivers. These are the real life public safety consequences of this budget that they built, and that's what we've got to get serious about mending.
But there were some surprises in your vetoes, autism program funding and money for PFAS cleanup at municipal airports and rural hospitals, and of course a lot of focus on Pure Michigan. The list was long. Governor, what message were you sending and to whom with those vetoes?
Well, the message that I'm sending is to the people of Michigan that as your governor, I'm going to do everything in my power to protect the public safety, health, and welfare. You know, I love Pure Michigan just like the next person does. But the fact of the matter is, instead of having 4,000 drunk drivers and sex offenders go unmonitored, I'd rather spend money doing that than on an ad campaign. Can we do both? Absolutely. And it means that it's time for the legislature to get back to the table so that we can meet both needs.
But yep, we look at, you know, autism program funding, charter schools. So that those are things that hit people right in their hearts.
It is. And you know what? These are things that I funded in the budget that I introduced 7 months ago. Unfortunately, the legislature started stealing money from places in the budget that it didn't really exist. And so I had to make tough choices to make it all balance. These programs are things that I've always long supported. So long as they don't create holes in critical functions in state government, I think that we can continue to do that. But that's what the supplemental process is for.
And as you've made very clear that the Republican plan for fixing the roads with the one-time spending was a shell game, and they say you vetoed the money you said you wanted for roads. So people want to know where will the negotiations go for road funding? Where does this leave things?
Well, I can tell you, when I said we're going to fix the damn roads throughout the campaign, it resonated with people because we know that our infrastructure is crumbling, and it costs us. It costs us in the form of new wheels, new shocks, new rims, new windshields. And this phony road plan that they put on my desk is the same kind of gimmick that got us in this mess in the first place. That's what I ran against. So I did my job in putting a real solution on the table. No one else in Lansing has countered with a real alternative, and until they do, we're going to continue to see this kind of mess, and that's precisely why I think it's incumbent on every leader to drop the partisanship and get back to the table and negotiate so that we can improve lives for the people of our state and protect the public health and safety and welfare.
In fact, we're going to be hearing later in this program from Congress members Dingell and Upton, each side of the aisle, about gridlock. And here we are with this gridlock over the state budget. What can you and your Republican colleagues do to prove to people that our state government is functional and the leaders they elected can work together?
Well, I'm going to continue building bridges, literally and figuratively. I have reached out to the Republican leadership in Michigan to try to make sure that we address the infrastructure crisis, that our children in third grade are reading, not 50th in the country as we are right now, and ensure that we close the skills gap. These are nonpartisan issues that I've always led on and that we're going to continue to lead on in hopes that they get serious about finding some common ground and do some good for everyone in the state.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And here to help us understand where this back and forth leaves us is Shayna Roth, reporter with the Michigan Public Radio Network. So, Shayna, you were listening to the governor. What do you think of what she's saying about where things stand?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be really interesting to really see in the long run where all of this goes, because right now she's been saying the sort of the same things that some Republican leaders are also saying, which is, you know, this has been a contentious cycle. We're going to try and move on. We're ready to work together. Let's negotiate. But I mean, this was just such a long fought battle, and both sides really said that the other wasn't working with them. Where this leaves them on other priorities and a potential, you know, supplemental or some other type of chipping away at what was vetoed and, you know, sort of reorganizing that money, we really just don't know if they're going to be able to come together, because some Republican leaders are saying that, you know, they're a little bit gun shy about sending something to her desk for fear that she's just going to veto it again.
But, you know, here we have Senator Shirky saying he's done. But do you think the appetite will be there amongst the GOP to revisit funding for some of these priorities like autism programs or PFAS cleanup?
It might be, particularly given, like, I know everybody's really worked up about the Pure Michigan thing. I mean, that's really something that hits, especially the House Republicans. A lot of them are in the Upper Peninsula and in Northern Michigan, which really likes the Pure Michigan campaign. So they might, but on the other hand, when it comes time for elections again, they are able to point to the governor and say she is the one that vetoed these. We tried to put money towards them and she vetoed them, and we weren't able to work with her after that. So, I mean, it's kind of a toss-up on whether or not they're going to try really hard to try and get some of these things back. I will point out that Shirky had said that, you know, if the governor comes forward and says that she made a mistake with her veto pen, that he would be willing to consider those sort of reversing those individual line item vetoes. But it's very tricky.
It feels like kind of a tense game of budget poker.
Yes,
with
indeed.
Cards and chips on the table. How are House and Senate Democrats reacting to all of this back and forth? Her party.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be a little bit similar. What's interesting is that Governor Whitmer announced that this supplemental bill that she wants to put together, that she has a lawmaker in mind to shepherd it through the legislature. Obviously, she can't write bills, but that would be Senator Curtis Hertel. And the Senate Democrats have been much more united behind the governor. They all voted against that K-12 school aid budget, whereas a lot of House Democrats voted in favor of it and actually sort of worked with Republicans to get some things in there. So it seems like she's still got all of her Senate Democrats. They're still very much in a line with her and behind her. Where the House Democrats stand is a little bit more amorphous. I think it depends more on each individual Democrat at this point.
Shana Roth, you have been covering politics for a few years now. What
yes.
is the temperature like in Lansing? Are things as Ooh. Tense as it seems from the outside?
It is a little tense. At least you would expect it. Yes and no. On the one hand, that's the thing. Like, it's odd because you talk to some lawmakers and a lot of Republicans are very almost blasé about it. They're like, yeah, no, we tried. We did our thing. Let's move on. And then on other things, they're getting a little bit worked up about it. So it just depends on what room you're in.
Michigan Radio's Shana Roth from Lansing. As always, Shana, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And coming up, in October 1871, wildfires claimed thousands of lives, destroyed millions of acres across the upper Midwest. The most famous fire hit Chicago, but big wildfires also struck several areas in Michigan.
From Holland to Port Huron, Manistee to Alpena, the Manitou Islands, these fires spread all over what we consider the central part of the Lower Peninsula of Michigan.
In 10 minutes on Stateside, the Great Michigan Fires of 1871. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Those of us who live in Michigan know that outdoor recreation is such a big part of what our state is about, from boating to fishing, camping to kayaking, hiking to skiing, and of course, hunting. All of that outdoor recreation creates hundreds of thousands of jobs, and it pumps billions of dollars into Michigan's economy. And that's why the state has created a brand new office to focus on outdoor recreation. Here now is the director of Michigan's new Office of Outdoor Recreation Industry, Brad Garman. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So what is your mission for this new office?
The Office of Outdoor Recreation Industry is all about sort of tackling the notion that our outdoor recreation economy is not a significant part of what makes Michigan work, and putting us sort of on a national playing field with that, because truly our outdoor recreation economy is a major part of Michigan's opportunity, its kind of quality of life and everything else, but it provides jobs. And there are some major manufacturing companies here. There are hundreds of small and mid-sized companies that are part of this industry, and we've never as a state really tried to wrap our arms around that group of businesses and those jobs and see how we can support them and how we can grow them and how we can make that part of really our mission as a state is making that part of the economy really hum.
Give us an idea, Brad, of some of the companies that you're talking about. What do they make? What do they contribute to our outdoor recreation industry?
Absolutely. The outdoor recreation economy in Michigan is really diverse, because it's everything from major manufacturers such as Carhartt, it's a familiar brand name, They have been in Detroit, Michigan since the late 1800s, and they are still one of the major players in the outdoor recreation economy. They make workwear, but they also make kind of recreational stuff. So if you're hunting, if you're fishing, Carhartt, if you're out in the winter, you're wearing Carhartt to do some of your recreation. And they're a big player in that field. And all of that stuff is designed right here at the headquarters of Carhartt right here in Michigan. To the other end of the spectrum, so you get like the world's largest manufacturer of kayaks, Hemisphere Design, is based up in Muskegon. And they're, you know, making kayaks and selling them all over the world. And they're based here in Michigan because it makes sense for them to be here. We're the Great Lakes state, so water is a big piece of that. So on one end, you have the major manufacturers that we're trying to wrap our heads around, the Shoemakers, the Wolverines, the Merrill, the Chaco, all those things. They're Michigan brands, and I don't think enough people are aware of that. And then you take it all the way down through to the consumer and sort of the destination folks who are helping us use that equipment. So you get the ski resorts, and you get your downtown bike shops and gear shops and things like that that are part of Michigan's sort of quality of life in our communities. And so that's where people are buying and being taught how to use a fat bike or how to paddle a stand-up paddleboard and those kind of things. Those are all parts of a really high-functioning and really large economy here in Michigan. And honestly, we have not really focused on that because I don't think we realized what a big player we are. So we actually have more direct jobs in the outdoor recreation space than a state like Colorado.
How many jobs and how much money are we talking about?
So in Michigan, there are 232,000 direct jobs. According to the Outdoor Industry Association, they did a study in 2017, and that's sort of the one we're building on. But it's, you know, the number they put on the total spend on outdoor recreation just in Michigan is $26.6 billion and $7.5 billion just in wages and salaries in this economy. And that kind of captures everything from like the tourism that's driven by outdoor recreation. If you're heading up north with your ATV or your pontoon boat, any of that stuff, straight through the manufacturers who are selling things and doing that stuff too. So, and all the retailers and all the support that goes with that. It is a major piece of the economy. And increasingly at the national level too, they're realizing recent studies show 2.2% of the entire nation's GDP is around this outdoor recreation space. And it's growing faster than the overall economy. So it's a space that Michigan can really do well in as it's growing and getting bigger and more important.
And by the fact that you now have this, you are the director of this new Office of Outdoor Recreation Industry, you've got a budget. That also means you're able to join a national coalition to promote outdoor recreation. Who's in that national group and what's the hope?
Yeah, so this is a thing that we'll be heading out to Utah to sign on to something called the Confluence of States. And this is sort of born out of Western states, Utah and Colorado, and some of those that are similarly seeing that their outdoor recreation lifestyle and the jobs and the economy that grows from that is so important that they realize that we should be gathering as an industry and helping sort of focus on all the additional benefits and things that you see from that. So the Confluence of States, Michigan is the first state out of the Great Lakes region to be signing on to these Confluence Accords, and they'll get us working on things like workforce attraction, retention, development, and support, working collectively on issues such as public health and how outdoor recreation economy can make an impact as a collection of folks who have a vested interest in keeping people a little healthier by encouraging them to get outside. So it's a win-win for the industry and for people who are living a little bit more active lifestyle. So they're focusing on that. And then we're trying to grow the industry and make it a more inclusive, more welcoming space. You know, lots of studies show that our national parks are often a predominantly white space. And how do we make sure that everybody who wants to get outside, regardless of color or ethnicity or race, is able to get outside and enjoy our outdoors and feel comfortable and welcomed in that space? So these are all big issues at the national level. The outdoor recreation leaders are thinking about, and Michigan wants to be, as we have been in the past, sort of a leader in that, and joining this Confluence of States helps us do that.
And then just focusing back on Michigan again, what's your job one? What do you most want to get started with as you wrap your arms around this new job and this new department?
Yeah, one of the first things I'm hearing as I've had the opportunity to go out and meet with some of these Michigan businesses, some of the 1,500 boating manufacturers, small and large, throughout Michigan and those folks, what I hear most frequently is concerns about workforce and how do we attract and retain people here in Michigan to work in these places. I think the perception nationally has always been to get a college degree or a certificate that gets you into the labor force and you're focused and your interest is in the outdoor recreation space, you pack up and you head to Boulder or you head to Seattle or you head up to Vermont or somewhere like that. And we're trying to change that to make sure that our companies are already here and that are providing a great quality of life and a salary and a benefit and everything else that they can keep the workers they need, because that's sometimes a struggle for them. So workforce is a big one. And then really trying to rally some of the resources that we've got for small businesses that are ready to grow. The Economic Development Corporation of Michigan has a ton of really helpful resources for small, medium-sized companies. And we want to target some of that into the outdoor recreation space so that if you've got a new product or you're a small company or a wheel manufacturer such as Velocity over in Grand Rapids who makes components for bicycles and you're small and you want to grow, how do we make sure that you can find and I can provide a pathway into some of the great tools that Michigan's already providing in that space? So connecting those folks to that. And then, lastly, and this is personal as well as professional, I really just want to change and elevate the perception of Michigan as an outdoor recreation state so that we can be seen right alongside of Utah or in Oregon as a great outdoor recreation place, so that people who want to work in the industry and feel that they want to live a great outdoor recreation lifestyle, they want to hike, they want to bike, they want to hunt, they realize that Michigan is actually second to none in the opportunities that we have because of the quality of resources we have, the amount of public land, the state forests, as well as the Great Lakes, the Blue Ribbon trout streams. We are really a gem of a state, and we have the economy to prove it, and we just want to start playing and competing at that really high national level.
Brad Garman is the director of the brand new Michigan Office of Outdoor Recreation Industry. Brad, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
It is Wednesday, and you know that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
The Great Chicago Fire is undoubtedly one of the most famous fires in U.S. history. It burned from October 8th to October 10th, 1871. It killed some 300 people, destroyed thousands of buildings in Chicago. But did you know, on those very same days, fires broke out all around the upper Midwest and right here in Michigan? Rachel Clark of the Michigan History Center is here with us. So, Rachel, safe to say the Great Chicago Fire rather overshadowed the Great Michigan Fire of 1871?
It did. Everyone remembers hearing the story of the Chicago Fire, and very, very few people, even people in Michigan, know about these fires of 1871.
So thinking about that day, so October 8th, 1871, what towns, what cities, what areas in Michigan were battling fires?
It was all over. So we have from Holland to Port Huron, Manistee to Alpena, the Manitou Islands. These fires spread all over what we consider the central part of the lower peninsula of Michigan.
So it wasn't just like, gee, on the west side. I mean, it was really all over the state. And then I was reading that our Wisconsin neighbors had a horrific fire that actually jumped the Menominee River and spread to Michigan.
They did. The Peshtigo, Wisconsin fire, that was the one that spread into the Menominee, across the Menominee River. And that fire burned a total of 3,900 square miles or 2.5 million acres. That was a huge fire.
Wow. Wow. So, we've heard the legend that Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicked over the lantern, which started the Chicago Fire. And I remember there's that, hot town in the old town tonight.
Yes.
I remember singing that as a Girl Scout. What caused, or do we know what caused so many fires to break out all around Michigan? I guess, first of all, what kind of summer had it been?
It was very hot and very dry. And with most natural disasters, you have multiple things that sort of just come together in this perfect storm. I don't know if that's the word you want to use.
Yeah,
but
sure.
These things that come together. So the summer was incredibly hot and incredibly dry. And then you also have the logging industry inadvertently was contributing to this, because as they're logging out these large areas of Michigan, the crews would go in, they would cut down the trees, and they would remove them, but they would leave all this stuff behind known as slash. Mm. And this is the debris, this is the twigs and the leaves and the little bits of wood that just didn't make it out. And with no tree cover, that vegetation dries up very, very easily. So you get a very hot, dry summer. You get this undergrowth and vegetation that is no longer protected by these very tall trees that had been there. And then you also get these very windy storm systems that are blowing through. Mm. So you have those three things together that create this perfect environment for fires. And in 1871, you have to remember, all of our light is either kerosene or some other fuel oil and flame. So it's very easy to believe that somewhere a spark happened and then everything else just was already in place for these fires.
So the wind, for example, if it, let's just kind of hypothesize. Mm-hmm. So let's say that Holland, there was a fires in the west, and then the wind, what, blew sparks and mm-hmm. basically hopscotched around the state?
That is one of the theories, yes.
Okay. And there was also something I heard about a comet.
That is one of the theories, too, because in 1883, this comet theory starts popping up, and it becomes a somewhat popular theory because so many fires started in so many spots. And it's not just the Chicago fire and then the Michigan fires. You have prairie fires in Iowa, in Minnesota, Illinois, Indiana. So there are so many fires that are starting in very close proximity and in time frame to one another that the theory is only a comet that was going overhead mm. could have sparked so many fires at one time. So that theory was an 1883 theory. It still pops up today every now and then, but
there's no
proof of that.
Okay. So we know that the estimates are some 300 people died in the mm-hmm. Great Chicago Fire. What about loss of life with these fires in Michigan and then the big one in Wisconsin?
The Michigan totals are very difficult to come by, mostly because there were so many people, loggers, and these logging camps that were very mobile, that it's difficult to say how many people got stuck in these fires. There was a number I saw for Tawas City alone, or Tawas Point alone, there were 200 people that died. Wow. So the Michigan totals are very, very difficult. Upward of 500 people is sort of the number that comes up most often, but it's very difficult to say. And then Wisconsin, their numbers are devastating. So anywhere from 1,200 to 2,400 people that die.
Wow.
That's in those fires alone. And then Peshtigo's got about 800. So those fires were absolutely devastating. They killed so many people.
There must have been, after all of these fires, a tremendous need for lumber. We got to rebuild. Mm-hmm. How did that impact Michigan's logging industry?
It boomed again. So we get this increase in not only the logging industry in places like Muskegon, but more mills start popping up because they have to mill this lumber. And so we have an increase in that lumber boom. They didn't understand entirely how the logging industry had contributed to these fires, so they didn't really change any of their habits. And we end up seeing more fires 10 years later.
Oh, yes, but in the Thumb, right?
In the Thumb mm-hmm. fires. And yeah. That's the same thing. It's the same sort of cause. And so we end up having to log more because we're rebuilding Chicago. We're rebuilding these towns and cities in Michigan, not only their buildings, but their furniture. So this is where you get an increase in that furniture market in Grand Rapids
mm.
because everything was made of wood and everything was burning. So they really started booming in Michigan, that not only the logging industry, but also the furniture industry.
And I know on Stateside, we've talked about the lost town of Singapore.
Yes, we did.
It was that, and that was a result of all of the logging that was done to help rebuild after the fires?
Yes. So Singapore was on the shores of Lake Michigan. It was a dream of rivaling Chicago and Milwaukee. The surrounding area, though, was deforested after the fires to provide this timber for Chicago and Holland and all those other places. And Singapore was actually sitting on very sandy ground, and with no root system and tree system to protect it, the sands of the shores of Lake Michigan actually ended up swallowing that town, almost literally. So Singapore is one of the towns that did not survive the aftermath of these fires.
Fascinating stuff. Rachel Clark, Michigan History Center, bringing us the story of the many, many fires that raged around Michigan on the same days as the Great Chicago Fire, starting October 8th, 148 years ago in 1871. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This week, world-renowned opera singer Jessye Norman died at age 74. Norman received her master's degree from the University of Michigan. While she was a postgraduate student at U of M, she spent the summer of 1968 at the Interlaken Arts Camp. Here is Jessye Norman performing a piece from composer Richard Wagner in Kresge Auditorium, August 3rd, 1968. That archival audio of Jessye Norman from 1968 comes courtesy of the Interlaken Center for the Arts. Coming up, my conversation about bipartisanship and civility with Representatives Debbie Dingell and Fred Upton. That is next, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Name-calling, punching back, finger-pointing, it's what we've come to expect out of Washington. U.S. Representatives Fred Upton and Debbie Dingell are calling for a return to civility and collegiality at the nation's capital and, more broadly, in America. I spoke with Dingell and Upton this morning ahead of their appearance at the Detroit Economic Club. Here's our conversation.
So you're both here today to speak to the Detroit Economic Club. You've got Southwest Michigan, Southeast Michigan, Republican, Democrat. What is your mission in being here today?
Well, this is actually the third time that Debbie and I have joined together to talk about civility and bipartisanship in Michigan this year. We did the Mackinac Chamber of Commerce annual meeting. We did an event at Ford School in Michigan. They asked us to come here. But the bottom line for us has always been we want to work together to get things done. Hey, we have a divided government today. We got a Democratic House, a Republican Senate, and a Republican president. The only way you can get a bill enacted into law to do anything, whether it's pass a budget, appropriation bill, pipeline safety, PFAS, which is an issue here, Great Lakes, it has to be bipartisan. And if you stay in your own corner, nothing gets done. And that's not who we are about or who we want to be.
And I know in that op-ed that the two of you wrote, Congressman Dingell, you wrote, a vibrant republic depends on vigorous debate. But we've got this nation where public debate looks like people standing in their silos, listening to their cable networks, reading posts in their social media, and knowing that they're right and the other side isn't. What are we doing wrong as a society?
Well, I think we have to work very hard not to do that. We've got to work very hard to listen to each other, to understand we have different life experiences, different perspectives. It's one of the reasons I like my district so much, because you all are based in Ann Arbor, and Ann Arbor's got very strong feelings on a number of issues. But you go through my district, and you've got Dearborn, which is Ford Motor Company headquarters, the largest population of Muslims. And downriver, you've got auto workers that are on the picket line right now. They have different life experiences, different perspectives, but they all love this country. They're all Americans. And we got to talk to each other. We got to hear each other. We've got to understand perspectives.
And what about the 6th District?
Well, my district is very diverse as well. Whether it be a blend of urban and rural, whether it be big businesses like a Pfizer, a Stryker, a Whirlpool, even our ag sector is very diverse. So, you know, we have the number 1 and 2 blueberry producing counties in the nation. But we've got livestock. I've got a county that, as we say, has 10 times more hogs than people. We've got a county with, it's got maybe 100 yards of a 4-lane road all told. And, you know, the ethnicity is there, from Germans to Lithuanians to African Americans to Muslim. I mean, it is who we are. It is our country. And, you know, as I have seen quite a bit, people don't really care if you have an R or a D for Republican or Democrat next to your name. They just want the job done. You know, they're soccer moms. They care about the economy. They care about Michigan. They care about the Great Lakes. If there's one really unifying thing, it's whether you live on one of the lakes or not, you care about the Great Lakes in a major way. So that's who I is.
Well, as we sit here speaking, it has been exactly 2 weeks since September 18th when the Washington Post reported that the president was the focus of this whistleblower complaint. We now have an impeachment inquiry going on in the House with new revelations each day. How would you describe this moment in our nation's history?
Well, you know, I was asked that a little bit earlier this morning in another forum, and we are not single-issue people or a Congress. We have to be ready for anything, and if there's one fault about this job, it's you don't have really any time to smell the roses when you get an issue that you really work hard on to get it done, because that plate is just so full. This is now another issue that is on our plate. And although I did not support the impeachment inquiry this last week, I did support, as did every member of Congress, Republican and Democrat, the release of the notes of the transcript that came out. And it, you know, there are a lot of questions for a lot of different people, and I'm not one to reach a conclusion at this point. There's got to be a lot of answers. It's going to take some time to figure out what not only the questions are, but to hear from the right people in terms of where things are, and we'll see what happens at the end of the day.
So do you think what the president did, as you read that, deserves further investigation?
Well, I'll take it. I watched just a little bit of the oversight subcommittee hearing, I liked what Mike Turner, my Republican colleague from Ohio, said publicly. His statement was along the lines, and I'm paraphrasing here, was, this is not okay. And it, you know, the questions need to be answered, and it's going to take some time to go through it. And, you know, we have so many other issues to deal with as well that the country wants us to work on. I mean, we just started a new fiscal year. We passed yet another continuing resolution. These things sort of happen. The Senate hasn't passed any of their appropriation bills. We have bills that are in conference, our defense authorization bill, military pay, all those different things that are a normal day for us, let alone our committee work. You know, I'm the top Republican on the Energy Subcommittee, and I serve on the Health Subcommittee. So, and we have, you know, each of us 750,000 constituents all wanting, you know, certain things and travel back and forth. I mean, it's a crazy, and families. You know, I got a daughter who's pregnant for the first time and a great wife. And I mean, there are so many things that you have to juggle to try and do your job well.
Do you feel you're at a point where you can support the impeachment inquiry?
It's too early to judge. It really is. We had a vote last week to table it. I voted with all my – it was a partisan vote. But, it, you know, there are a lot of questions that are legitimate that we are all going to want answers to.
And, Congressman, this moment in the nation's history, what is this to you?
You know, I've been very concerned and have been very clear about that over the last few months, especially I had a lot of people, Tom Steyer, MoveOn.org, and I didn't like the direction or what I was seeing, but was very worried about how divided this country is, because I think we need to be concerned about that. And the Mueller report itself, which nobody talks about, says that Russia is trying to divide us as a country. But this became very crystal to me, and this to me is not about partisanship in any way. When it became public that a whistleblower had filed a complaint, that President Trump appointed Inspector General investigated the whistleblower's report, found it to be credible, found it to be urgent and a potential danger to our national security, and that the acting director of Homeland Security was also concerned about it, my job is to protect the national security of this country and to protect the Constitution. I take an oath to do that. We have to follow the rule of law. That is what keeps this democracy together. And nobody is above the rule of the law. So we are now investigating facts that have been put forward. 300 senior national security officials of both parties have said that there's a pattern of corruption that's endangering our national security. I don't know how much more serious this gets. And it's sad, but I want the facts. We've got to follow the facts.
The president and his supporters say that he is being attacked by journalists and by Democrats who are still angry over his win in 2016. What do you say to Americans, to people in your district who stand by the president and believe this?
I talk to them a lot, as you know, and I tell them exactly what I just told you. It's one of the reasons that I was willing to take so much anger and pressure this summer, because I was worried about how divided we were. But these are facts. This is an inspector general appointed by this president giving us facts. There'll be classified briefings that'll occur this week. We also need to make sure that we're protecting this whistleblower. The whistleblower law, Senator Grassley, Republican from Iowa today, came out concerned about what's happening to this whistleblower. And I think we have to make as much public as we can. So I think the American people understand this. They understand that an inspector general has said something's happened that's endangering our national security. That we need to, as much as we can release, to have people understand it's very important, because we need to try to keep people together as we are investigating.
And Congressman, to people who say, I can't understand how Republicans are silent in the face of what many people feel is corrupt and alarming behavior, what do you say to those people about their concerns?
Well, you know, it's actually nice to get out of Washington for these 2 weeks, and because it is almost, you know, the story broke, as you said, about 2 weeks ago, and it seems like there's new developments every hour. I mean, just today, Debbie and I are doing, getting ready for the Economic Club. We're doing a number of different media events like this one, and it seems like at every stop, there's something new that's coming out. So, you know, and you know, the process is, you know, there's no joy in Mudville about this, and I say that from Democratic friends and Republicans as well. And I was one that actually went through the Clinton impeachment issue. I was in Congress back in the 90s. And I was reminded, looking back, how consuming it was. And I'm not a lawyer. I wasn't on the committee. I went to read the Star Report. I remember going to the Ford building to look, and that was before cell phone camera. You couldn't do that anyway. You couldn't even take notes to look at it. And I was one that did not vote for all of the items of impeachment. There were four counts of impeachment. I was the only Michigan Republican not to vote for all four, as I recall. And this is going to take time. I mean, just every day there's new questions. There's new statements. Chuck Grassley, a friend, former House colleague, though I didn't serve with him, way before he was in the Senate, different members. I mean, there's going to be a lot of air in that balloon as we look at all the issues, frankly, we have to deal with. So I don't know that anyone is really silent. This is not an issue that you can go hide in the corner on.
Opinion polls show, as you well know, public approval of Congress is at an historic low. Gallup poll in June, just to point out, found 20%, only 20% of Americans approve of the job Congress is doing, 75% disapprove, although approval for you as individuals is much higher than for Congress as
a
whole.
Thank goodness.
You got to go back 10 years to find a single Gallup poll where Congress approval rating was at 30% or above. You both have long histories of being involved with the House. What do you think has broken down between Congress and the American people?
You know, I think President Trump, I've said this many times, got elected because people were tired of partisan bickering. When I'm working my district, which I do a lot, and I'm out there, I hear people wanting us to do something about lowering the cost of prescription drugs. I hear my UAW members on the picket line talking about the jobs we shipped overseas and that are never coming back because of bad trade deals. Fred talked about the Great Lakes earlier. I think they don't see us working on the issues that matter to them or making a difference. And we got to come together and find that common ground that is going to impact the lives of everyday working Americans across this country, who just, they don't want a lot. They want to be able to have a job, to make enough money to live in a safe neighborhood, put food on the table, be able to afford to go to the doctor when they need to, take their medicine, educate their kids, and have a safe and secure retirement. Those are issues we stop talking about.
You know, I think there's a perception, in large part the media is responsible for this because that's where people get their news, and that's what they see Washington does. But there's a perception that things really are absolutely partisan. They see the hardcores on both sides, sometimes screaming at each other. and on the evening shows as well, cable news networks on both sides. And as I look at my area, people don't really care. They could give, you know, I won't say it on the air, they could give a damn about someone having an R or a D next to their name. They just want the job done. They don't think of their neighbors as Republicans or Democrats. They think about them as their son or daughter's on the soccer team, or they're going together to go work at the business. They're going to go have coffee. They're running, jogging. I mean, they're doing all these family activities, and it's not partisan. And they turn on the news and they see partisanship. That's why I think I've done well in you know, the different appearances that I do. And that's frankly what my voters and constituents want us to do. And there are a lot of good ideas on both sides of the aisle. And with a divided government, if you're going to get something done, you darn well better work with both sides.
Well, let's talk about, like, how do you fix this? What is more than a plea? What are some concrete steps that you feel, particularly working on the Hill, that could break us out of this tribal logjam we're in? How do we do this?
Well, I think gerrymandering has contributed to it. My district, which is a solid Dem district, but at least has different perspectives, so you're forced to listen to them. But I think people running in more competitive districts will partially address that. But I think everybody's got to become more involved. I think that democracy thrives when people are engaged and involved. I do see people more engaged than I've seen them in a number of years, but it's not just up to us. It's up to everybody to be engaged in the process and to tell their legislators that they want to see them actually get something done.
Engaged beyond tweeting, retweeting, Facebook posting.
Well, I think social media is the worst thing that's happened to us. I think it is a source of bullying. I think it is a source of negative rhetoric. It is changing the tone and creating divisive rhetoric that's contributing to absolutely nothing in this country, and is also keeping people from building relationships and trust, which also helps people get things done.
Just to follow up on that quickly, so we worked as a delegation on protecting the Great Lakes. As part of that is fighting the Asian carp, which even a fourth grader usually understands, at least on my side of the state, but I know over here as well. But even when you do that, the social media goes after you. It's like, I mean, you got to... You don't really look at it if you're one of us in a lot of ways. But to answer the question, though.
The how?
Yeah.
How do we do it?
So you got to have people, men and women, that are committed to network and to really establish a trust and a friendship with each other. And I'm part, and Debbie is too, I'm actually one of the vice chairs of a group called Problem Solvers. It's a bipartisan group, 48 members. We meet weekly. Talk about issues where we can work together. And we've had a good number of successes. We were the ones responsible for getting us out of that doggone government shutdown. We met with the president and the vice president in the Situation Room and told them what we thought, where we could go, and that ended up being the package. We were the ones helping to get the money for the border. We went down there to Texas, and we saw that it is a crisis down there. And what is it that we can do to make sure that it's not just Border Patrol people down there?
How many members?
There's 48 members in our group, so it's equally divided. And we meet for an hour every single week. We're actually going to meet even during this break. But at the end of the day, you got to work together, and that's what our group is all about.
So how do you take that fraction of the members of the House and expand feeling?
So remember, the House is really pretty narrowly divided. So one of the things that we did at the beginning of this legislative year was, and we told both, had the Republicans won the majority, would have been the same thing on our side, we successfully changed the rules of the House to really foster more bipartisanship with sort of inside the baseball rules. But at the end of the day, they are beginning to work. And our group on the Democratic side told Speaker Pelosi that they were not going to support her for Speaker unless she agreed to the rules changes. And we had the same on the Republican side. We told Kevin McCarthy weeks before the election that if we kept control, we Republicans were going to hold our vote back as well until he agreed to the changes. Speaker Pelosi did. We've used those changes in a variety of different ways to really see the beginning of what I hope will be a long-term relationship on more bipartisanship.
I think people want to see us get things done. I think they're tired of government not working for them.
And that was Representative Fred Upton, Republican from the 6th District of Michigan, and Representative Debbie Dingell, Democrat from the 12th. Thank you both very much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.